navies blockading Ukrainian Black Sea ports, including Odessa. They even started this invasion force. They put mines in the sea. There are 94 ships that are blocked, non-Ukrainian ships from various countries that are blockaded or blocked in Ukrainian Black Sea ports. They have wheat, they have sunflower oil and other things that are desperately needed in a number of places like Egypt, Yemen, and others. And they're not going to get to those destinations, I'm afraid, because the blockade is still there. It's a huge problem. I mean, it's gonna make more people starve because of malnutrition around the globe, really. And Russia just should wake up from doing these horrible things. It's not just that they're doing it to Ukraine. They're actually doing it to common sense and decency and the other peoples in the world.
And Volodymyr, very quickly before we conclude, people are fearful now that there's a massive Russian offensive coming in Donbass.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and KBOO Community Radio is very proud to be the first FM station in the state of Oregon to program jazz. Let's celebrate KBOO's diverse jazz programming and the jocks who volunteer their talent to share their love of jazz music. Jazz Appreciation Month, or JAM as it's affectionately known, represents a sweet spot in the lives of KBOO's music lovers. So join us on Wednesdays, noon to 4, and Saturdays, 2 to 5, throughout the month of April, as we toast America's greatest art form here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's unemployment rate falls to near historic levels, heralding economic recovery. In Washington State, doctors call for more actions to save African-American mothers' lives. And advocates for good government want to get voters and polling places ready for the next elections. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 14th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. The latest unemployment numbers are out, and they show some encouraging signs for Oregon's economic recovery. KBOO's Josh Salem has the story.
Oregon's employment rate fell to 3.8% in March, nearing the record low figure before the COVID-19 pandemic, when it was 3.4%. State employment officials noted a gain of 5,600 non-farm jobs last month, on top of 9,700 jobs the month before. The jobless rate spiked 2 years ago, when many businesses closed due to the pandemic. However, there has been a recent and steady rebound. The strongest job growth has been in the construction and financial activities sectors, which together accounted for about 52% of the new jobs in March. Other recent trends include a hot real estate sector in a cooler leisure and hospitality area. Real estate, including rental and leasing, was responsible for all of the growth in the broader finance sector. Leisure and hospitality did gain about 900 jobs, but that figure represents a significant slowdown. The Oregon Employment Division did comment that jobs are almost all the way back to pre-COVID numbers. A video they released yesterday said, quote, "Oregon has regained about 9 out of 10 jobs that were lost in the pandemic recession. That's similar to the U.S. End quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
People for Portland is going to try again on a ballot measure to crack down on public camping. The nonprofit group is pushing Portland area leaders to get tougher on the homeless and wants a new approach. But its new filing looks about the same as the first one. Lawyers from the regional metro government rejected its first attempt. It would redirect money from a voter-approved Metro Homeless Services measure toward temporary shelters instead of affordable housing and services. It's Black Maternal Health Week, and health professionals are focusing on the disparities in mortality for Black people giving birth. As Eric Tegedoff reports, they include a Washington State doctor who says racism manifests itself in the body.
This week is Black Maternal Health Week, highlighting the disparities in health outcomes for pregnant people. Black mothers are 2 to 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related complications than their white counterparts. Dr. Gemma Nonog is Director of Health Equity for Kaiser Permanente Washington's Thriving Families Program and also practices midwifery. The doctor says there are similar mortality rates in Washington and that the pandemic has exacerbated the issue of structural racism within the health system. Nonog says racism manifests in the body.
The extra stress causes preterm birth and amplifies some of the things that we see even before the pandemic.
In 2021, the White House began recognizing Black Maternal Health Week and has released a proclamation this year as well. Nonog says there are important warning signs for pregnant people to look out for. They should reach out to a health professional if they have headaches that won't go away, fainting spells, or unusual swelling. Nonog says they also should be aware of thoughts of harming themselves or their baby because this could be signs of a mood disorder. Perhaps equally as important, the doctor says, is that people know they deserve to be heard.
As a BIPOC provider who also is a parent, it can be difficult to really speak up. Given my own history of internalized racism, I had to work 3 to 4 times harder than my white counterparts just to be heard or valued.
Nonog says Kaiser Permanente is supporting pregnant people in other ways too, such as monthly cohorts that meet with health professionals. The doctor says the health organization also is trying to step back to understand its role in addressing structural racism.
We are listening to the community, inviting them in to give us feedback of what they need. And we're trying to look at the data. We're trying to assess any implicit bias that we might have.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Groups that fight for clean elections are recruiting hundreds of poll monitors and educating the public about universal vote by mail and new vote centers. Suzanne Potter reports on the efforts of good government groups to recruit nonpartisan poll monitors and prepare voters.
The June 7th midterm primary election is less than 2 months away, and clean elections groups are working to clear up misconceptions and recruit nonpartisan poll monitors to make sure things go smoothly. During the pandemic, the state started sending mail-in ballots to every registered voter, and last fall, the legislature made that permanent. But Alessandra Lozano with California Common Cause says a lot of voters mistakenly think we've done away with in-person voting.
We've been encountering a lot of folks who think that we are exclusively a vote-by-mail state now because of the passage of AB 37, and we're reminding people that they have multiple options, whether it's by mail or in person.
Ballots will be mailed out in about a month. 6 years ago, state lawmakers passed the Voters' Choice Act, which allowed counties to expand early voting and set up local vote centers with the option to reduce the number of neighborhood polling places. For the June primary, Riverside and San Diego counties will transition to this model. People can go to their county registrar's website to find out the closest place to vote. Lozano says Common Cause is also recruiting about 200 nonpartisan volunteers to do spot checks in those counties, plus Los Angeles, to make sure polling places are set up correctly and that election materials are translated into other languages where it is legally required.
those folks are responsible for making sure that all is well and good, that that location is complying with all state law, and also answering any questions that voters might have.
Voters also should be aware that redistricting means they may be in a new legislative district with new candidates running. The last day to register to vote is May 23rd. You can sign up for texts that track your ballot at wheresmyballot.sos.ca.gov. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court is considering a case challenging the use of absentee ballot drops in the state after a lower court ruled in January that drop boxes were not a legally permissible way to cast a ballot. Jonah Chester has the story.
After a lower court held they weren't a valid way to cast a vote, Wisconsin Supreme Court on Wednesday considered whether or not absentee ballot drop boxes are permitted under state law. The lower court's January opinion held that the boxes, although previously permitted by the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission, weren't specifically authorized by the legislature, and therefore aren't a valid method to cast a ballot. Attorney Stephen Kilpatrick, appearing before the justices on behalf of the Elections Commission, argued state law gives clerks leeway when administering elections.
Therefore, they're giving discretion to the municipal clerk to set up these secure drop boxes as a way for absentee voters to return their ballot.
The High Court's decision will determine whether drop boxes can be used in future elections, including this year's upcoming fall races, where two pivotal lawmakers, Democratic Governor Tony Evers and Republican Senator Ron Johnson, will be up for re-election. While it barred them at most locations, the lower court's ruling permitted drop boxes at clerks' offices and in other specific scenarios. It also held people filling out absentee ballots must be the ones to mail or return them to the clerk's office, and ballots can't be submitted by an unapproved third party. That prompted a flurry of hypotheticals from the court's justices Wednesday, who questioned the attorney representing the plaintiffs in the suit on several potential situations. Justice Brian Hagedorn, the high court's key swing vote, asked how far that chain of custody rule should go.
If I'm mailing an absentee ballot and my wife takes the 3 steps to put it in the mailbox rather than me, have I violated the law? Do we need to decide that question?
The lower court's order barring drop boxes has previously been both upheld and blocked by the state Supreme Court. Shortly after the lower court's initial decision, they permitted drop boxes for the spring primaries, holding clerks didn't have enough time to adopt alternate rules. Later, the high court barred drop boxes for the April general election. In both cases, they didn't rule on the underlying legal validity of the boxes. For the Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Jonah Chester. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A 2016 study found that less than 60% of American adults are financially literate. Now, as Mike Moen reports, some policymakers are debating about adding a money course requirement to education.
The tax filing deadline is fast approaching, prompting many to think more about their personal finances. Some policymakers, including Minnesota legislators, feel that reflection should start at the high school level with required courses. 4 states have recently adopted laws making personal finance a graduation requirement. Beyond that, 7 other states already have such laws on the books. The topic came up during a recent Minnesota House Committee hearing. Representative Hodan Hassan is a sponsor of a bill that includes a course requirement, arguing the state needs to ensure high school graduates are ready for the real world.
It's imperative that our students learn basic personal finance skills, as it is one of the most important things that you can do to live a healthy, happy, and secure life.
The proposed requirement is getting some resistance from advocates for administrators who worry about reducing time for elective courses. The Minnesota bill has bipartisan support, but timing may be an issue at this point in the current session. There are also questions about implementation right now, with many students still catching up on learning because of the pandemic. Kimberly Lewis of the Minnesota School Boards Association says financial literacy is important for teens and young adults. But she argued certain elements are already included in current standards, and that offerings such as career and technical education courses can be just as helpful.
The CTE classes give students an opportunity to understand where their careers might lead, and they can get certifications in many cases for good paying jobs to help them not get into debt.
She also noted that giving local school boards the chance to implement standards that meet their needs is better than a blanket requirement. Iowa is among the states that already have a financial literacy benchmark students have to meet in order to graduate high school. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on gentrification and real estate. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. Tonight's weather, we'll see some clouds, temperatures dipping below freezing, down to 29 for the low. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy and up to 53. For the weekend, we will likely see showers on Saturday up to 52, then down to 31 overnight. Then Sunday, temperatures will climb all the way to 58. Today in history, on this date in 1865, John Wilkes Booth shot President Abraham Lincoln. Our quote of the day is from Lincoln, who said, "I am not bound to win, but I am bound to be true. I am not bound to succeed, but I am bound to live up to what light I have." Authorities arrest the suspect in the New York City subway attack. The U.S. pledges another $800 million in military aid to Ukraine. And officials brace for a migrant surge at the southern border as Title 42 expires. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here is today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
My fellow New Yorkers, we got it. We got it.
New York Mayor Eric Adams on the arrest of Frank R. James, the 62-year-old man suspected of carrying out Tuesday's attack on the New York City subway, which left 10 people shot. James was charged in federal court in Brooklyn with committing terrorist and other violent attacks against mass transit systems. In Washington, Vice President Kamala Harris reacted to news of the arrest and praised New Yorkers.
There's no question it was tragic, but it also did demonstrate the incredible work that is being done by first responders, by law enforcement officials.
President Biden has approved the transfer of helicopters, artillery systems, and armored vehicles as part of a package of $800 million in additional military aid to Ukraine. Defense Department spokesman John Kirby.
Tailored to meet urgent Ukrainian needs for today's fight, as Russian forces shift the focus of their ruthless aggression now to eastern Ukraine.
In a speech at the Atlantic Council Wednesday, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen delivered a stern message to China and other countries that might help Russia evade international sanctions, and said the ultimate outcome for the global economy depends on the path of Putin's war.
While many countries have taken a unified stand against Russia's actions, and many companies have quickly and voluntarily severed business relationships with Russia, some countries and companies have not.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki on Wednesday defended President Biden's public comments earlier this week, calling Ukraine war crimes genocide.
And we've also seen, I think, from the beginning of this, Kremlin rhetoric and Russian media deny the national identity of the Ukrainian people. And the Kremlin has launched a full-scale assault on the sovereignty of the Ukrainian state and its people.
White House officials are bracing for an expected migrant surge at the border when Title 42, a policy allowing the U.S. government to expel migrants before they had a chance to file for asylum, ends at the end of May. American Immigration Lawyers Association President Alan Orr said Title 42 helped fuel the crisis at the border and a backlog of asylum cases.
And when the Biden administration took over, they promised to fix these humanitarian concerns because the very things they thought Title 42 was solving, it created.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
An Alaska bill seeks to regulate forever chemicals which cause cancer in Native communities. Native Mainers plan to boost traditional tourism. and a new partnership with Jane Goodall. Here's today's edition of National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska Native advocates are supporting legislation that would expand testing and regulations for trace amounts of PFAS, chemicals in Alaska's groundwater that's been linked to cancer and other serious health conditions. Alaska State Senator Jesse Keel has sponsored legislation that would police seven varieties of the so-called forever chemicals that don't break down and often enter the environment from firefighting foams used at airports.
These things are bad for people in extremely small amounts. We're talking about parts per trillion in your drinking water.
The Juneau Democrats bill comes in response to Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy's move to water down Alaska's regulation of PFAS found in industrial and household items, including nonstick cookware. Jackie Boyer, policy director of Native Peoples Action, an indigenous rights group in Anchorage, told Alaska senators that American Indians and Alaska Natives are at risk of getting certain types of cancers.
This impacts individuals, families, babies and children, and animals and fish. And there may be more in the future. Additionally, the contamination may compound in individuals already exposed by continuing to practice our ways of life by hunting and fishing contaminated sustenance.
Alaska senators also heard from local officials in Yakutat. The community of 600 has PFAS contamination in wells near the airport. The tiny community is facing a $6 million cost of extending water mains to supply households and businesses where groundwater is contaminated by the forever chemicals. Indigenous people in Maine are working on a plan to boost tourism for the state's five Wabanaki nations. They're set to take part in a state tourism conference this week. Lily Bulkey reports.
The Wabanaki Cultural Tourism Initiative has received both a federal grant from Health and Human Services and a state grant from the Maine Office of Tourism. Charlene Virgilio is with the Four Directions Development Corporation, the first Native community development financial institution in northern New England. As a member of the Penobscot Nation, she says cultural preservation is central to the project. Its goal is to create unique experiences to share the ways that Wabanaki people have long been stewards of the land and water.
Canoeing, kayaking along the ancestral rivers that we have, traditional fishing methods, whatever those kind of things that will help preserve culture, but also help tourists experience that culture.
Virgilio adds authenticity is a key component for many Wabanaki communities interested in boosting tourism. Matthew Lewis, also with Four Directions and a member of the Passamaquoddy tribe, says in addition to preserving and sharing culture, this effort is a way to bring more revenue to Maine's indigenous communities and boost the local economies. He says there are so many artisans in the community to engage with, for instance.
Tourism can sometimes have a negative connotation with some communities, saying we don't want folks just driving through, taking pictures, doing the sort of like Disneyland package. We want meaningful engagement with the community and meaningful engagement with the culture.
Lewis adds, as they map out the robust four-season tourism industry that they hope to achieve by 2030, they also have to consider what infrastructure is needed, from hotels and restaurants to workforce development and hospitality training.
That was Lily Bulkey reporting. The Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, announced this week a partnership with the Jane Goodall Institute. The partnership is intended to increase youth programming. It will offer a summer internship for one IAIA student and 5 to 8 mini grants for Indigenous youth. A virtual event is planned for May 12th and will feature guest speakers, including Dr. Jane Goodall. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Preparations for Route 66's 100th anniversary are underway in Oklahoma. COVID-19 cases fall, but food insecurity remains, and egg and poultry prices climb as bird flu hits dozens of states. More on this in today's Yonder Report.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. It's traditional egg season, but they'll cost more due to rising prices caused by an outbreak of bird flu in more than 20 states. The flu poses no threat to humans, but Salise Christie with Practical Farmers of Iowa says at least a dozen Iowa counties have seen outbreaks. Even farmers with small flocks of poultry may have to take drastic action.
They have a bird that tests positive, and then they have to cull all of their flock.
bird flu outbreaks are sometimes blamed on concentrated animal feeding operations that typically come with big ag. Patty Lavero with the Campaign for Family Farms and the Environment says the nation has become too reliant on factory farms.
We are putting so many animals, often that are genetically identical, together in one place. The disease just runs through very quickly and does a tremendous amount of damage.
While cases of COVID-19 have fallen dramatically, food insecurity has not, especially in rural America. Currently, 90% of the counties with the highest rates of hunger insecurity are rural. Tamara Sandberg with Save the Children says hunger is putting children's growth, development, and well-being at risk.
More than one in five rural children are estimated to be experiencing food insecurity, which is higher than pre-pandemic levels.
The nonprofit's California director, Chloe Chambers, says many farm workers still can't afford to feed their kids the produce they harvest.
We're seeing the same need, and when we have distributions, we're running out of the food boxes, so we're working really hard to get them out to as many families as possible.
Some schools will extend free meals into the summer so kids don't go hungry. The travel industry is expecting a significant rebound. AAA says cruise ship bookings are making a comeback. Lingering pandemic concerns and higher gas prices may keep some people closer to home. Lee Barnes with Intrepid Travel believes the pandemic caused a fundamental shift.
I think we're seeing an increase of people traveling to connect, to understand themselves, understand their own culture.
That means more travelers may opt for their own neck of the woods.
There's been an increase in walking, trekking, water, canoeing, etc.
And if you're making travel plans for 2026, Canute, Oklahoma, population 500, wants to make sure you'll get your kicks for the 100th anniversary of the legendary highway through its town.
We've got some things in the work to revitalize our community ahead of the big Route 66 celebration.
Kathy Shones with the town's preservation group says they want to evoke nostalgia associated with long road trips when drive-ins, motels, gas stations, and neon signs line the 2,000-mile highway from Chicago to L.A.
We're going to try to get people that own any kind of property along Route 66 through Canute to revitalize what they have.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 14th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Josh Salem, Mike Moen, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Data Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 VH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. So if you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on gentrification and real estate. That's coming up next. We'll be right back.
Like some of the proposed solutions that's coming from the grassroots level.
You're listening to Making Contact.
I'm Salim Mahamrouhani, and on today's Making Contact.
My understanding is there is not a single county in the United States where a minimum wage worker can afford the average apartment.
We talked to Samuel Stein, author of a book called Capital City, Gentrification and the Real Estate State, about why it's so expensive to live in modern cities.
What we're seeing is a transformation of where investment capital is going around the world. The bulk of the world's investment is now in real estate, meaning the ownership of land and buildings on top of it for profit.
His book explores what international capital has to do with rising rents and what we can do to fight the global capitalist class.
If that much money is invested in the proposition that rents will rise continuously, then renters' ability to slow that down, to stop it, or even to reverse it can have tremendous impacts on the global capitalist class.
It's a cold, windy day in San Pablo, a city in the Bay Area in California, which is